Marsh from Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Good morning, everyone. We know you had a great time with our Q&A extended session last week, so we decided to follow up on everyone's favorite topic during that debate, Sagar and my discussion on our differing perspectives on Ukraine and Russia. So we decided to dedicate an entire episode to Russia, a possible second Cold War, our history. Sagar, who is the guest that's going to talk about with us today?
This is a big honor for me because I'm just such a big fan. Was the creator of The Americans, Joe Weisberg, who wrote a book, Russia Upside Down, an Exit Strategy for the Second Cold War. Joe has a fascinating background, was in the CIA, but before you say, oh my God, he's a spook, he's actually somebody who wants to empathize more with the Russians and is somebody who is actually asking and wrote a book for Americans to try to put themselves in the mindset of Russia in the context of so many of the conflicts that we face here in the 2010s and now in the 2020s. So we talk about the specifics of Ukraine, but I think more importantly, what we talk about with Joe is about what it means to empathize with somebody else whenever you're an adversary. But there's a lot of little nuggets in here for filmmaking, for Hollywood, what he's working on next, all kinds of cool stuff. I think people will enjoy it.
Yeah, this is obviously an episode about the US and Russia and Ukraine, but taking a step back, he does a great job of writing a book that's focused on this theme, a theme that we love on this show of being aware of your biases. Why do you believe what you believe? And how can you actually think through problems actively? So a lot of great stuff. Y'all are going to enjoy this episode. We really recommend the book. Quick shout outs before we go into the show. Tips. Appreciate tips. They help Aaron with his lunch money. Aaron, the crusher producer who is helping us really helpfully in his senior year of high school. Secondly, we've got a bookshop. Of course, there's a bookshop for this episode. It's Thursday. So especially because this is a contentious topic, Russia, Ukraine, what we should do. We want your user-generated, audience-generated feedback on this episode, your personal opinions. We'd like to showcase as many of those as possible. So send us a quick note at realignmentpod@gmail.com and subscribe to the Substack in the show notes. Finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Here's the episode. Joe Weisberg, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you, Joe.
Thank you.
There's a million things we're going to cover, but let's just cover and start with the most obvious news-related matter. Ukraine seems to be in a real standstill. There's lots of hot and heavy words exchanged between the Biden administration and Russia. Where do you see the situation as standing, and where do you personally, how do you personally approach the questions that we're looking at there?
I've been thinking about this really constantly because I wrote a whole book about trying to kind of think differently about our conflict with Russia and the new Cold War. It seemed like we had slid into, and now this is almost like a test case, even for me. Can I sort of keep my brain from falling into all the usual zones of we have to be tough, we can't be seen to be weak, we have to watch out for appeasing them. Can I resist all that when a war might break out any second? So it's really been very much on my mind, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about it a little bit. I think what I've been focusing on for a while is that when we get into this kind of conflict, obviously we retreat to our corners and think about how right we are and how wrong the other guys are. And if you read the press or the newspapers or watch TV, you know, you can see that pretty clearly happening. Although I don't follow it very closely, I'm fairly confident the same thing is happening in the Russian media. And so to pull back from that and say, is it possible to actually have some understanding of what they're saying? To not just paint Putin and the Russians as just aggressors, as just people who want to get back the Soviet empire, but rather that they have a valid point when they say very clearly, hey, you guys keep moving NATO towards us. We're getting, you know, more and more feeling encircled and feeling like we're not safe. And instead of dismissing that, or instead of jumping up and saying, well, every country has a right to its own sovereignty, which is true, by the way, but instead of just saying that, to say, hey, I think the United States would feel exactly the same way in the same position. And so I can actually understand that. That's where I think I'd like to sort of move the conversation towards, or at least in my own head, where I try to focus.
You know, this is good. I'm glad you started off that way. So here's the immediate question, and this isn't a cheap shot, so I hope you take it as such. How do we differentiate between good faith empathy and just bad faith empathy, in the sense that you just gave a good articulation of a fair steel man perspective on how a Russian could look at the situation, NATO expansion, encirclement, all these different issues. During the pre-World War II era, Nazis, all sorts of bad actors, the Italians, Mussolini, would also make arguments that we now know were obviously uttered in bad faith. So when we're cycling through these decision points, how do you suggest we differentiate between good faith fear and bad faith fear?
To a certain degree, although I think it's an important distinction, I think the valuable thing is less making the distinction and more being careful with what we do. Being careful that we don't base all our policies on actions on a naive assumption that the good faith interpretation is right. My guess is a lot of times in reality, and we can talk more if you want about the analogy with World War II. I don't think it's a fully appropriate analogy here, although it is the one, you know, everybody's using. But my guess is this is a better example of a situation where it really isn't one or the other. It really isn't that everybody there in Russia in power is just thinking, boy, if they could only understand our legitimate concerns. And it's also not one where everyone in power is saying, if we just put that BS out there, we can trick them. Well, we plan secretly to get whatever we want. My guess is it is a complete hodgepodge, with those being the two ends of the spectrum, and all kinds of people, or maybe everybody, not exactly in the middle, but having pieces of all of it. That's how complex these things are. So I would say we have to not be naive. We have to not assume that empathy and understanding solves the problem, but it's a good place to start. And then we're careful with what we do. We don't, for example, just, you know, put ourselves in a position where we could be hurt, where we could be attacked, and we make policy changes or compromises that are reversible. I think that's one of the really big things.
Joe, can you give the audience, you wrote a whole book about this, give the audience a little preview in how you arrived to this. Obviously, with your background, you wrote an entire show, hundreds and hours of scripted television, trying to put your mind into an adversary. You know, we'll just use that word without judgment necessarily. How exactly did you arrive to this point where you found empathy to be an important tool to then extrapolate to general American foreign policy?
As you point out, it's a very long story. It took a whole book. So if I'm being honest,
it's a podcast, you got plenty of time.
All right, here we go. When I first went into therapy in my late 20s, no, that's to some degree, I do start out there, because when I went into therapy, I started in order to sort of get by emotionally and deal with stuff I was facing in my personal life, I started opening up to the idea that all the things I was thinking and feeling were not so simple, were not black and white. I was a very black and white thinker, not just about politics, about my personal life. Mm. And that you can't get very far that way. So in therapy, I started really opening up to nuance and seeing how nuanced my feelings were, how nuanced my relationships were, how nuanced the emotional world was. And then it was not that hard to kind of transfer that to politics, because in politics, I just thought the Soviet Union was the evil empire. We were the good guys. Essentially, I don't know if I would have said everything about them was bad. I probably wouldn't have said everything about us was good, but the things about us that were bad were sort of okay because we had good hearts and good goals. So I really saw it in such binary terms, and my brain started working in a different way. And then a lot of different things happened. One was, you know, in terms of applying it to politics, that I read this book that really had a big impact on me by a former KGB officer named Viktor Cherkashin. And the Soviet Union had fallen a couple of years earlier, and now former KGB officers wrote books, which wasn't something that would have happened during the Soviet era. And as I read about his life and his career and his friends in the KGB, the overriding thought I had was that they sounded like me and my friends at the CIA. And I had had this view of KGB officers as such awful people, as so unrelatable. I read this book and I almost completely related to this guy. And I started thinking, with my personality and all the things that made me want to be a spy, if I had worked in the Soviet, if I'd lived in the Soviet Union, is it possible I would have joined the KGB? And my answer was, I do think that's possible. So that sort of set me on a path where I said, well, if I got this wrong about the KGB, I wonder what else I got wrong about the Soviet Union. I had studied the Soviet Union a lot, not just in college, but afterwards. And so I started looking and also doing research for the Americans, just looking for stories. I started looking at all different aspects of Soviet society and looking at it with fresh eyes, not clouded by having to just find evidence of them being bad.
So this is helpful. And once again, a podcast, so feel free to expound on this. But I was listening to a couple of your interviews and read the book, obviously. Help us understand what I would probably say are the four different Soviet unions. So there's the initial Soviet Union where many figures on the political left are very, they're very excited. This is the new future. There are the five-year plans. It's the 1920s and 1930s. So there's a lot of skepticism of the Western model. There's that version. Attached to that version was obviously the purges and the Holodomor and all of the terrible Stalinism. There's the Soviet Union that comes out of World War II. Before Stalin dies, there's Khrushchev's Soviet Union leading into Brezhnev and co. Then there's Gorbachev's Soviet Union. And I would guess that given your statement that you would see yourself joining the KGB, there are times when that could be seen as being a neutral thing. There are times where joining the KGB during the purges in the 1930s were very obviously, from my perspective, evil. So how should we understand these differing versions of the Soviet state from a historical perspective?
Thanks for asking that, because I sometimes get so sort of wrapped up in some of the things I'm saying that I forget to make the distinction, which is really crucial and important, because, you know, two thirds of what I say about sort of get understanding the Soviet Union more, being more sympathetic to it, not seeing it as an evil empire, I'm really talking about the post-Stalin era. Mm-hmm. And certainly when I say that I could have joined the KGB, maybe I'm talking about the post-Stalin era. Now, the Stalin era was, as you say, you know, horrible famines, horrible purges, incredible political persecution, millions of people imprisoned, killed, the worst. If you want to use the word evil, that's not a bad place to put it. So I don't have as much of an objection there. It is still more complicated than I had viewed it. Like when I started to study it more and learn about it more and kind of learned what people's lives were like, even in the Stalin era, the ones who were not going to jail or being executed, there was still sort of life going on in a way that was really interesting. Sheila Fitzpatrick is a historian who writes in really interesting ways about this. But the most interesting thing for me is to try to understand how so many people today in Russia still like Stalin. I mean, the polls show that something like 50% still have various ways in which they like and appreciate Stalin. And I spent that was one of the hardest. I thought, how could I ever understand that? That is like almost like Hitler. It's almost as close as you get to evil. If half of Russians have positive feelings about Stalin, are they crazy? Are they evil? What's wrong with them? And I had to really dig deep there to get a sense of what it was. And I think that what it was that we tend, and certainly I tend, to say if you have someone like Stalin, how could you ever look at anything positive about that? But that's not how a lot of people feel in Russia. A lot of people in Russia feel he did these horrible things and they don't deny them. Putin's an interesting example. Putin doesn't deny the horrible things Stalin did, but they also see that he was the primary force that industrialized the country, that built the country up, that brought a huge number of peasants out of extreme poverty and sent them to college. And you think about that. You think about you grew up, you know, almost barely able to eat, farming, and then your parents or grandparents got brought into the city and sent to a college. And pretty soon you had a job working for the government where you had a much more comfortable life. Would you support that guy to some degree, no matter what he did? I think for me, I like to think the answer would be probably not, but I do sort of understand that there are a lot of people who feel differently about it, that their lives were so miserable and got so much better that they have some level of support for him. So anyway, I'm not answering your question super directly, but I think that's the heart of what you were asking. And I think the other thing I'd like to add is that, you know, I read in the book about when, to some degree, I myself feel that I wish the Soviet Union had not collapsed. And there too, I want to get to that final stage you point about, that I'm talking about Gorbachev's Soviet Union, right? If Stalin's Soviet Union had still been here and collapsed, that'd be good by me. But Gorbachev was really trying to take the country in such a humane and decent direction. And by all accounts, he was such a essentially really good person. He was and wanted the best for his people and did, you know, he had in many ways shared a lot of our political values. So I think about where could the country have gone if it had kept on the course he had it on? And I think that might have been good.
So here's a question, Joe. Where did it all go wrong? Because, you know, obviously the Putin narrative of this is, oh, Gorbachev was a fool. He allowed the West to come in. They raped us. They allowed Yeltsin to come in. They destroyed the country. Monetary, everyone knows the story. Inflation. Yeah, we have McDonald's and we have blue jeans, but now we have homeless for the first time. This was something that never would have happened under Brezhnev in the 1980s. As you say, I get it. I get where they're coming from. I understand.
True enough. There's enough. There's true enough there.
I mean, yeah. Like, it took me a while, also, a lot like you. I had to start reading a lot more Russian history and more to even understand and answer that question. Like, how do these people like Stalin? Like, what are they saying whenever Putin is like, it was such a tragedy? I'm like, oh, actually, the daily experience of most Russians was terrible in the 1990s. And they like stability. A lot of people like stability. It's an uncomfortable truth that most people don't want to acknowledge. What part of this narrative is true? Are they cherry picking? I mean, given your long experience, like with the country, how do you see that that period and how we arrived to where we are today?
I think you described a lot of it pretty well, and I think what I would say is there's enough truth in there, right? There's enough truth in there. You know, we tend to there's a phenomenon that I wrote about in the book that I'm pretty interested in, which is, when it's us, it's fine. When it's the other guy, it's not fine. Mm-hmm. So if you look at us, the United States, you know, we all understand how we have cherry-picked the best things about our politics, the best things in our history, and tried to build a self-image around them. And one of the things that's happening in our politics right now is that's falling apart. And there's certainly a positive aspect of that. We're getting a broader view. A lot of people are not so satisfied just looking at what's good. And a lot of people who really only want to look at what's good are really angry about that and can't stand it. And so there's a lot of conflict there. So the tendency to only look at what's good is, I think, pretty universal, and you have to fight against it. If you look at what you were saying about their view about what went wrong and why, you know, Putin is popular, that probably is also an example of cherry picking. You know, the stuff that we did to hurt them, the mistakes that they made, all the stuff that went wrong.
Right.
But it doesn't mean those aspects aren't accurate. It's pretty easy to sympathize with that point of view. And I want to really emphasize what you said about stability, because as Americans, until pretty recently, things felt pretty stable here in a lot of ways. And we really took it for granted. And it was really hard to understand other countries that did not have that history. And as a consequence, the people prized stability so greatly. But it's not that hard to understand. If you just think about countries that have suffered repeated wars, if lack of stability means your family might be killed next year, you might care a lot more about somebody running the country who could essentially keep peace and keep civil war from breaking out than you care about, for example, voting. Now we're getting maybe we're getting a taste of it now. It's hard to say, but I'd say at least a little.
Yeah, I mean, one second, Marshall. I would just say, from my own personal experience, you know where I learned a lot about this was Iraq. I was like, you know, after the fall of Saddam Hussein, and then being like, well, you know, for a lot of them, it was better when Saddam Hussein. And this is a very, once again, uncomfortable thing to say. If you were one of the Kurds who got gassed with, what is it, sarin? Yeah, it wasn't great. But, you know, for a lot of Sunnis, there wasn't the same level of, you know, inter-religious warfare and repression. And I had to arrive at this very uncomfortable place of thinking and acknowledging, wow, I mean, you know, people will sacrifice a lot for stability, even if it means paying taxes under the ancient Islamic laws to the Islamic State. And that was a difficult thing for me to personally have to arrive to. Go ahead, Marshall.
Yeah, I'm glad, Joe, that you went to the good and evil section and America transitioning from stability to instability, because my reaction to a lot of what you were writing is, I actually really enjoy the way you integrate your personal journey, but part of my critique is can we make foreign policy decisions from the psychiatrist's couch, mm-hmm. in the sense that it's really important to move beyond 1980s good versus evil. Rambo 3, maybe, I think that was Rambo 3, Rocky 4. That was not a sustainable model for approaching America's role in the world. And like Sagar says, that really culminates when you add in end of history, post-1990s arrogance, that culminates in Iraq and the worst parts of the Afghan conflict. So I understand why that needed to be pushed away from, especially from when that really peaked in 2003 with Freedom Fries and everything. Here's my concern, though. It's one thing to debate good versus evil. Are we virtuous? Are we city on the hill? When things are stable, it's another thing to try to give that nuance when things are unstable. So what I basically mean by this is it feels like we're just missing something. It feels like moving away from the 80s was a good thing, but it hasn't made us any happier or effective as a society adding the nuance. So can you help us? So I'm not saying you're wrong, but it seems like there's a bit of a missing gap there. It seems that in tearing down the national mythos you're describing, it hasn't actually led to a better series of outcomes in the US. So I'd just love you to just reflect on that dynamic.
I think that's well said. I really share your concern. You know, when it's funny when you say, can we run foreign policy from a psychiatrist's couch? I think that's a funny and smart way to put it. And I don't know the answer. You know, I'm not here saying I'm sure we could. I'm more sort of saying that if we took it sort of in this direction, that more people tried to look harder at where their own individual politics were coming from. I'm sure we can all agree that's good for the psychiatrist's couch, right? That's not gonna do any damage, right? So if we can all sort of take a look, and I'm not by any means the first person to make this point, but come to understand that our politics is, you know, really coming from our emotions and our feelings. It's not a set of facts. You know, it's, we have these feelings and then we sort of pick the facts to match them up. And then we tend to get devoted to those and they become beliefs and we're sure they're right. That doesn't work so great and creates both domestic and international conflict. So I have a suspicion, but it's only a suspicion, that if more people could pull back and say, I mean, let's look at it domestically in our own country. If, you know, we're so almost at war with each other, and if more people on each side of that conflict could pull back a little bit and say, this belief system of mine is not a universal truth, and therefore I can actually connect and relate a little more to somebody who disagrees, we're still going to disagree, but I can have enough respect for that. I can have some basic sympathy for it. If enough people did that, I think we could pull back somewhat from the brink, maybe. Maybe. I mean, it's very, you know, it's certainly very wishful thinking, but I think it's possible. On the international stage, you know, it's interesting because I feel like if you look at the sort of political consensus about Russia, right, it's really not a Democrat, Republican, or conservative liberal issue and never has been, really. There's really a firm consensus that the U.S. has to be the international light of democracy, has to push it all over the place and has to fight against anybody who, you know, has a different system. That's a, I think that view, first of all, is fading to some degree in the population, but the mainstream politicians still cling to that pretty strongly. And that incites action. And that incites a need to be the international policeman. And I remember in the 80s, I remember people questioning international policemen and how well that worked, but it never really got traction. It just continued. It's almost like that is driving policy no matter what we do. And whether it's the psychiatrist's couch or something else that shifts the mind frame, I don't see how it changes unless the mind frame changes.
Hmm. It's interesting. I'm glad you brought up the Civil War illusion, because we did an episode on the coming Civil War. Not that we believe that, I think that rhetoric's a little overheated, but the useful place we ended, though, was it seems like what's driving the dynamic is what you actually just articulated, which is that we tore down city upon the hill. It's not morning in America. The 80s have been moved on a couple of different levels. But what we lack is a national foundational story that could encompass, you're in LA right now, I'm in New York right now, Sagar's in DC, we disagree at different levels, but at least there's this underlying foundation. So as a person who is a storyteller, literally, in terms of your actual day job, What do you think? Two ways to ask this question. So one, what do you think a coherent national story could be that provides a foundation? And if you don't have one, because I don't expect you to have one off the top of your head, how does one get to the process of actually developing a coherent story?
I want to first say that, you know, just tie it in, that such a huge part of that story was that we were fighting the communists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a battle between good and evil with the Soviet Union, and then the Soviet Union went away. And we lost that national myth, and Russia lost it too, right? They had the flip side of it that was an important part of what sustained them. And so in the same way that people talk about how Putin has come into this vacuum without a national myth and story there, and some people say, well, he's trying to use the Orthodox Church in Russia to fill some part of that void, and that may be true. How conscious or how much part of the void that is, I don't know. But it comes from probably an understanding that people need something like that. And so here, it doesn't seem like a coincidence that our national myth started falling apart with the end of the Cold War. It seems causal, right? And I don't really know how to build up a new one or how to fill it. In a way, I think what I kind of push in the book is the idea that we almost try to expand our kind of national consciousness a bit to accept more nuance and look at things in a more complex, nuanced way and let that be satisfying. But mm-hmm. if you ask me realistically, do I think enough of a population of as huge as this one going to move in that direction for that to essentially fill those needs? I think not. I doubt it. I'd be surprised. I'd be happy, but I would be surprised. That's more something that's worked for me and filled some of those voids in me. But I don't have an answer, but I'll pile on about the problem that I've been reading. I talk a little bit about Carl Jung in my book, but I haven't read that much Carl Jung, but I've been reading a little more, or really reading people writing about him, which is a little easier to understand.
I admire your honesty.
I was gonna say, let's be real here.
But anyway, one of his big and I think very powerful points is as the world population became significantly less religious, as religion didn't go away, but it was reduced and faded. He said that basically, if you think the human needs and behaviors that the needs filled by religion, behaviors that resulted, if you think those are gone, you're wrong. They are 100% as active as present as before, that human beings needs religion or something like religion. We've always had it. It's a fundamental part of our soul. It's part of how the human psyche works, and it will come out in different ways. And then an example of another way that could come out would be fascism. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about your show in this context, because something you did a very good job of in The Americans was actually making me feel like I'm in the 1980s. I was born in 1992. I didn't live through any of this. I've only read about it. And there was a real realism to the fact that the characters ran a travel agency, that there was stuff on the television and the TV, right. Had Reagan in it. And I can't explain why, but it was very helpful in telling and conveying the characters that you were giving. But what you portrayed in that was that ethos that you're talking, the central foundation of the Soviet Union and the United States kind of together. Can you talk about what is it like to then create in the current times? So obviously that was a historical drama, and maybe you can even tell us a little bit about your new project if you feel comfortable. But what is it like considering the metacultural trends of today, vis-a-vis the show The Americans that you created, which was set in the past? What are the differences that you note whenever you're writing and creating?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll, before I answer the question, I'll tell you a couple things. One, let me do some quick math. 92,
29. We're both 29.
You're both 29. Yeah. I want you guys to know just how many travel agencies there were. I know you know there were travel agencies,
yeah,
but they were like every block. Yeah, they were like all like, over the place.
Yeah.
And they were crowded. Two people were in there making plans and planning trips. It's one of the most startling changes. And now they're gone. you know,
that'd be a if I saw two travel agents, I'd be very suspicious.
There was a
that
great
would be the worst. That would be the worst undercover position ever.
I forget what the episode was where there was like a travel agency convention, and I remember being like, "Who are all these people?" Yeah, he's like, "Hey, I'm so and so. I do, you know, a Buffalo, New York."
Very funny.
Yeah.
Very funny. They also had all those posters of the place they wanted you to look at the poster and plan your trip to Greece. And one of our favorite props was that machine that like would make the tickets. They had special machines that made tickets that were like, they were hooked into some crazy airline system, what you needed without the internet. But, and then the other thing I wanted to say was that, you know, my partner, Joel, who I ran the show with and wrote a lot of the show with, we used to joke that people would ask us, you know, what kind of research we did about the 80s. And we're like, we just remembered. All we had to do was remember when we were growing up. Right. But it's very interesting because Joel and I are making another show now about a therapist, a serial killer and his therapist. And it's present day. And first of all, it's not that, I don't think it's that interesting, but if you really want to know the truth, the primary thing that I notice is when we're doing set dressing and props and stuff like that, when you're doing something that's period, you have this just incredible focus on that because it's one of the part of the main thing that's bringing you back or what people see.
Yeah.
And it's in a way, it's a huge relief not to worry about that. You still care about your set dressing. You still care about your props, but they just be like normal things that
that's fascinating
that somebody got.
I wouldn't even think about that, but you're so right. What they wear is important.
It's very visual. The what they wear stuff was really interesting. We had a costume designer on the Americans who very early made the point to us that people in the 80s weren't going to be wearing all clothes from the 80s. They were going to have a lot of clothes from the 70s because people don't throw all their clothes out every 2 years.
Not everyone was hyper trendy, if you think about it.
That's right. That's right. Huh. So that had a lot of influence on us too. And it's in a way that, first of all, I love making a period show. It's a huge pain in the ass. And so, but the other thing,
the cars were so cool though. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I love the show so much. So it's like, I always think about the cars and I love the, you know, the chases and the, you know, the side-by-sides, like, man, you put me right there. Even though I live in DC and I know, you know, mostly wasn't shot here, but
I'm obsessed with the cars. I love the cars. Cars back then, as I'm sure we can all agree, were much better looking than cars now. They weren't so worried about gas mileage and things. So it was all design all the way. But making a TV show, you get all those cars from a company whose job is supplying prop cars to TV shows and movies. And the ones from the 70s are old and they don't run. And I mean, some of them do, but they don't run well. So the most important thing when you're shooting a show is to keep moving. Because time is really money and it costs a lot of money. And if you, for example, get shut down or have to stop for an hour, that's a huge deal.
Union.
So everything. So cars that are constantly breaking down are not good. Not good. So those cars were like our friends and our enemies.
Yeah.
But I your question is making me wonder something I didn't think about because the show we're doing now, you know, it's really almost all inside. And I wonder in a way if our way of hiding, like our way of sort of not, we're so traumatized by having to get, because when you're outside, it's even worse because people aren't driving those cars. Mm-hmm. So you have to block off the whole street and just have your cars there. And if a minivan drives by in the corner and you're shot, you can't use the shot or you have to use special effects to get rid of a minivan because they didn't have minivans. But you know, in terms of the larger question you're asking about kind of sensibility.
Yeah.
It's very funny. I think this show, we could have made it something that took place in the 80s. It's just like a coincidence, but it's not a show that's tied into Americans. It was so tied into politics and history. And I used to think how much history helped us because it helped us get stories. And this takes place now, but it could almost, and you'll know it takes place now, but the themes and ideas about violence and therapy and connection between people could be almost any time.
I want to spend a ton of bit more on the Hollywood side of this because it's interesting. I'm really interested in the aspect of you that's telling stories, if that's coming through. And what I'm thinking about is we just did an episode that's coming out next week of Eric Swartzel of the Wall Street Journal on Hollywood, China, all those different topics. And he was just discussing how Hollywood responded to World War II. So for example, you have Mark Harris's book and the Netflix series Five Came Back about how Frank Capra and other directors were deeply engaged in that struggle. And then we didn't talk about the Cold War. This really ended with him pointing out that, let's just say the Pentagon did not get as much cooperation from Hollywood when it came to the War on Terror for a couple different reasons. It's hard to have a compelling Iraq war movie that's positive, but could you just talk to us as a creative about the role that Hollywood depictions of the Cold War, how they evolved, how they went? Because as I'm thinking about it, you go from, you've got John Wayne in the, you know, 40s, obviously, but then you have, you know, Dr. Strangelove, you have Failsafe, and then you go to the, you know, the Deer Hunter, and there's all the Vietnam pessimism, but then all of a sudden it's the 80s, and then Rambo's there, and, you know, Rocky's, beating Ivan Drago and all those stuff. There's this huge pendulum swing. So I'd love for you to just talk about how you interpret that as when it came to depicting the Cold War, and how you think moving forward, Hollywood will tell stories in morally ambiguous or at a minimum complicated situations.
It's fundamental to it. So what I do every day is think about that stuff and think about how to tell stories and what they mean. And it's interesting what you're saying about the shift from some of those more nuanced movies that you mentioned. They come and go in a way. You mentioned The Deer Hunter. I usually cite that as my favorite movie of all time. And I was pretty young. I saw that when it came out, when I think I was 12 or something like that, when they came out. I was really young to see something so kind of violent and upsetting. It really had an impact on me. But I to this day think of it as such an extraordinary movie. And it's funny in a way that the same system will produce that and will produce, you know, Red Dawn, you know, and by the way, I liked Red Dawn.
Generational version was better than ours. In case anyone had the trauma of watching the 2012 reboot as I did.
Ours was better, but not a work of genius, but it tapped as Hollywood is so good at, it tapped into some, you know, like almost primordial desire. And, you know, like I wrote about this in the book, that I saw that movie, and although I wasn't exactly conscious of it, I wanted to drop out of high school and join a rebellion against the communists. That's like 100% what I wanted to do at 15. And the whole Hollywood system essentially knew that and made that movie for the millions of me's all around the country that just wanted to fight for a cause because we were young and because America was good and the other side was bad. But that same exact system also made The Day After, you know, pretty close to the same time, which was using kind of incredible, particularly visual and storytelling imagination to realize, but to do a kind of actualization of this unimaginable thing, nuclear war. It was unimaginable. We all thought about it. We were scared of it. We essentially knew what it would mean, but to put it on film, I mean, to put it on film so that you see it, it enters people in a completely different way. So I'm on balance, mostly kind of impressed by it, by the ability to hit all these different notes. And I feel like, to the degree that things like the Rocky part, the Rocky and Ivan Drago and the, you know, Red Dawn, to the degree that those are kind of playing into some cultural oversimplification that, as I write about, I think is harmful. I don't have any need to be easy on Hollywood, but I don't particularly blame Hollywood. That is our collective mentality.
Yeah.
You know, coming out.
So let me ask you this. This is even more of a meta question, which is that I feel like there is more content than ever, and not all, and most of it is terrible, and very, very few of them are really good. So as one of the creators of one of the, in my opinion, great scripted dramas of the 2010s, a time where there has not been some really trend-setting innovation, what is going wrong in Hollywood today? Or am I full of it? Am I just completely wrong in my narrative? Why do I feel that way? Why do a lot of people my age feel that way at the very least. And how are you trying to rectify it? What do you think is possibly going wrong inside of the system, if it is going wrong at all?
I'm not sure it's going wrong. You know, I'm having a problem of overload, that there's so much that I don't know how to sort through it. Yeah. But I do constantly hear from people, you should try this. This is actually great. You should try that. It's actually really, really great. And I don't, because I still can't work my way through the muck to get to it. But I hear that anecdotally about enough things that I've never even heard of that I think they are out there. And it's a
discovery problem.
I think it's a discovery problem. You know, I used to, I remember a couple of times when I would go, I started seeing, as many of us did, a lot of foreign shows that were really good. And I started really looking for top 10 foreign shows of whatever year it was, said by various critics. And I would usually, and then I would find on the list of 10, two or three that just seemed like they'd be interesting to me. And almost invariably, I liked them and thought they were great. I think we just, you know, everybody needs to find their own system to kind of cull it down. And if there's a lot of, stuff that isn't, you know, great or isn't to your liking, I mean, I'm not sure. All that's really doing is employing people like me. So I'm happy. I don't mean that I'm making bad stuff, but I mean, there's a lot of work for people in Hollywood because all this stuff is getting made. So from the inside, I tend to view that as a net positive. And worry less about the quality as long as there's a fair amount of good stuff.
That's interesting. So then let me ask you this. What is so different about making a television show today than in 2013, whenever you started The Americans, the period piece aside, the actual logistics of you as a person creating a television show?
It's surprising how different it is in a way. Although obviously there are a lot of similarities. You know, my partner Joel and I work at FX. We have a deal with FX, and that's a place that is really searches for high quality stuff and really pushes you in that direction and helps you achieve that. So that's all the same. I would say the difference is that because there's this kind of arms race going on between all these different platforms, when we were first making our show, just almost all shows were made much significantly less expensively. Because there were tight budgets and people were struggling to, I don't know if they were struggling to turn a profit, but there was a limited number of stuff made. And now there's so much getting made everywhere and so much competition, and networks are spending a lot more on shows because they want to have the best looking, glossiest, best looking thing. And so in a way there's like, there's less pressure in a way. Other than that, I think there is a, you know, when we made The Americans, we certainly felt there was a lot of competition. It would be hard to get people to watch it. And it was, you know, we to a certain degree broke through, but we never had really high ratings, but we did get known pretty well. Just as you were just saying, that has now gotten exponentially more difficult, like for a show to break through and for people to even hear about it. So that part's tough. Let's talk again after our new show is on, and I'll tell you if anybody watched it.
Yeah, no, more than welcome back. I have to do the least subtle pivot in the history of this entire podcast. Back to the topic of Russia in our last 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Look, this episode, the reason why we initially reached out is I was very interested at a meta level, like Sagar said, at your question of how do you off-ramp from a Cold War. So I think a useful place to start is I'm not quite sure we're in a second Cold War with Russia. I think we're in a Cold War with China, but it's unclear we're in a second Cold War with Russia. So given that that's what you literally believe we're in, can you establish what the difference in inception, in reality, what are the differences between the first Cold War between US and Russia? Like, when did it start? And then the second one, when did that one start? And why do you believe it is so?
I'm going to start with a slightly disappointing response, which is, I'm not sure it's a second Cold War. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And in a way, I think sort of what we call it isn't necessarily even that important. Calling it a second Cold War is a good way to get people to pay attention to it. And it also highlights something important, which is that it's dangerous. But the primary thing I would say is that I believe we're in a new, refreshed conflict with Russia that is quite dangerous and that reminds me a lot of the initial conflict. It obviously has some major differences that are really worth thinking about. The first Cold War was on so many levels an ideological conflict between, you know, capitalism, democracy as we defined it, and communism and the type of interesting autocracy, totalitarianism, whatever you want to call it, that they had over there. These were really different worldviews. And if we're now both capitalist countries and, you know, the other, we had one of our big complaints about them was that they were repressed religious people. If there were now both countries with a lot of accepted religion at our base, and the remaining differences are more that the political system is organized somewhat differently. Why? What is the conflict about exactly? It was much easier to understand that conflict because it cut to the roots of how we all saw ourselves, the story we told ourselves about who we are. I can't entirely figure out why we are or need to be in the conflict we're in today. And I think that gets to your other question about, you know, when how these conflicts started. It could be very hard to put a, you know, an opening date on the Cold War, but, you know, because the US and Russia were in conflict immediately after the Russian Revolution, when the US actually sent troops, you know, they didn't actually engage in any battle, but we were against this and felt strongly that this was a bad direction and communism was dangerous to the world. But generally people date the Cold War from, you know, more from after World War II, when, you know, the victorious Soviets and the victorious Allies kind of met in the middle and divided up Europe and started, you know, struggling over who was going to really prevail in both in Europe and theoretically. And it had different times when it heated up and different times when it got a little less hot. And then the Soviet Union was, you know, not exactly overnight, I don't think that's accurate, but to everyone's surprise, pretty quickly was gone. Right. And then it's also hard to date if it's a second Cold War, it's hard to date when it started. But if we just say, you know, when did the conflict with Russia ramp up again? I think it's really very fundamental to think about that, because what Yeltsin was in power in the 90s and then Putin came to power. And it looks to me like when he came to power, he had some real openness to the West and to getting along with the West. And there are different reasons to think this. One is that he just didn't talk or use the kind of anti-Western rhetoric he used today. Two is that he seemed to want to have trade with the West in the way that you only get when you're getting along pretty well. And then there's this very sort of well-known thing that after September 11, he was very vocally supportive of the West, didn't complain when we put temporary military bases in Central Asia, which had been, you know, formerly kind of might have been seen as their sphere of influence. And even let us fly over some of his airspace with various kinds of support for our troops. So what that looks like to me is it might have gone in that direction. Mm-hmm. And then I start thinking, so what are some of the things that happened next? And some of the things that happened next are what they are now talking about constantly, which is we started expanding NATO in their direction. There's a defense alliance, which was formed to fight Moscow, but really it's formed to fight the Soviet Union, which is gone. We keep the defense alliance and we start taking in not just former members of the Warsaw Pact, but former Soviet republics. That strikes me not just as something that I can understand them seeing as aggressive. I see that as aggressive. I think that's actually aggressive. And you could sort of track Putin's attitude and speeches and what he said and how he felt about the West. You could just see it deteriorating bit by bit. And then people, you know, a lot of people point to the war in Iraq and say that was something that sort of may have pushed him over the edge as seeing the U.S. as a dangerous force in the world. And we could go on and talk about many, many other factors. But it deteriorated in the 2010s, probably got significantly worse in the middle of that decade. And here we are.
Mm-hmm. I think my initial thing, the thing that's interesting for me, and I'm curious what you think about this, is it seems to me a central cause of this second conflict is frankly just Vladimir Putin. I think if Dmitry Medvedev was still president of Russia, we would have a different relationship between the two countries. Obama, you know, specifically writes about this in his book. This is very clearly remarked upon. The period when Putin was out of office for a bit, you have treaties like the New START treaty, which was about limiting nuclear weapons and missiles, different policies like that. I think this is what gets at my concern with what you're saying, not like at a analytical level, but just like what's complicated for me, which is I'm afraid that too often you are conflating Vladimir Putin with Russia. So I don't think Russia is evil. I don't think the US is necessarily aligned against Russia. I think the US is aligned against Vladimir Putin. I think Putin specifically has ambitions and desires. And it's easy to cliche these, but it is true. Once again, this is a person whose mind was frozen, it appears, with the greatness of the Soviet Union during that pre-80s period. And you would critique something, and I'm kind of ranting here a bit, but this was the part of the book I really loved, like your idea of interrogating where we come from and how that shapes our beliefs about the world. So I can be honest and say my beliefs are, I guess you could say I'm obsessed almost with capturing the spirit of what I felt like the 1990s were like, which is there is broad peace. There is broad, obviously there's the Balkans and there's Somalia, Desert Storm, but there's broad peace. There's broad consensus. We're moving in one direction. So maybe I am too captured by that, but it feels like Putin is captured by the 80s. So I guess that's just the question to you, which is how much of this is really about Putin? Is my Medvedev comparison incorrect? How do you think about that?
Certainly things would be different if Medvedev were president. But I would probably say it's not just a trick of fate or coincidence that he's not, and that Putin is probably, not only is Putin president for a reason, but a lot of that reason is that he is more representative of mainstream Russian views than Medvedev. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, Russian history, there have always been some Westernizers, some people closer to our point of view, some like Gorbachev, who are really interesting combinations of the two, and plenty like Putin, who were, had a very different point of view. And I think that, he's quite popular, as we know. He has approval ratings that would, blow away any American president.
And not the fake dictator. This isn't Stein was saying of his 99.7.
He unironically probably has what would you say, Joe? Like 65? I'd put him there.
It's often been around there. It seems to be a little lower lately. But if you think about high 50s, low mid 60s, when he's low.
Biden and Trump would kill for those numbers.
right. Yeah. Now,
the
a
last
lot of people,
president to be that popular is Bill Clinton.
Yeah, and also only for a little while. Mm-hmm. Putin, held numbers like that higher even for a pretty long time. And people will say, and I don't think it's entirely invalid, well, he's got control of the state media, and so all people hear is positive Putin stuff, and so that helps inflate his numbers. And I don't dismiss that, but I do dismiss the idea that that is the fundamental thing that accounts for it. I think the fundamental thing that accounts for it is what we were talking about earlier, that this is the Russian population is not, they're not thinking about democracy the way we do. That's not something they want. That's never been a value of theirs. The dissidents who I thought were like the Soviet heroes and I thought secretly represented everyone, but people couldn't say it or they'd go to jail. Well, that was just wrong. They weren't popular.
Who are some examples of that?
Well, like Sakharov or Sharansky or guys like that who, really had kind of Western liberal mentalities and wanted to reform Russia and were persecuted as a result. Sharansky, not just a dissident, but a Jewish refusenik also. So he had there was some distinction there that we could get into or maybe talk about another time because it's complicated. But the dissidents, it's a whole other episode. But the dissidents were not, they were heroes here in the West. They weren't heroes in Russia. And even after the fall of the Soviet Union, when for a long time, discourse was very free and you could find any information you wanted and people could talk, say whatever they believed. The dissidents were not revealed to be popular. It was the opposite. And sorry, I was referencing what we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. that I think a lot of this is that you have a population that historically has been run over, destroyed, suffered unimaginably, and they want a strong leader who brings stability. And Putin is that. the 90s, you were talking about some of the things that were good in the 90s, and that was a good list, but the 90s sucked at Russia.
Yeah.
it was overrun with crime. Organized criminals were incredibly powerful. The economy was just became disastrous. You know, we all remember the pictures of old pensioners selling their used underwear on the street. I mean, it was bad. And Putin came in and he essentially reversed that. And I think that accounts for a lot of his popularity too. And people point out that was a long time ago. And there's some degree of what have you done for me lately in Russia about Putin. So it's not like he's been able to coast entirely on that forever, but I don't think all the support he got from that has gone by a long shot either. You can coast for quite a while on that.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with you, Joe. I mean, this is one of those things where, once again, maybe I'm better at this just because my parents are immigrants and I'm used to looking at countries in a little bit more of a dispassionate way and just being like, okay, like, how does this work? And The history of Russia tells you that the Medvedev, and I'm channeling Lenin here, the Medvedev type figure is this like ally of the capitalist West who wants to interpose these values, which are actually very distinctly not Russian. Like, if you look at the history of Russia, it rhymes with Putin. It rhymes very much both in terms of people forget this. The peasant class are the people who loved the Tsar the most. It was the aristocrats and the industrialist bourgeoisie who actually hated him because they were stopping. Autocracy was basically bad for business. Here's the thing, Joe. People will say, and have used various arguments of saying, sorry, are you basically calling Russians stupid? Are you saying that they don't love democracy? And I'm saying they don't think about it the same way that you and I do. How do you explain that to a Western audience? This is just something that people in the US just don't get because they've literally never lived through it. A lot of them have never experienced, like, you know, my parents from India. Modi's popularity actually makes a shitload of sense to me. It's not complicated if you understand India at all. But here everybody's like, oh, fascism, you know, and I'm like, no, like, it's complicated. How do you explain that to people here?
It's just about, you know, the simple fact that it is no coincidence that we have our type of democracy, and it's no coincidence that they have what they have got. Yeah. It is not in either case because very, you know, a powerful individual has used some kind of political trick to take over. Our whole entire history has been building up this system for us, and that's why we got it. And theirs is something else. And you just have to open up to that. And so the sort of constant, and by the way, this is a little less bad than it used to be, but it's still pretty prevalent. The underlying assumption that other countries have to be run like ours is run is not a good assumption. And back to the therapist couch, the underlying assumption that that guy over there or this person next to me or my best friend or my spouse or you have to be exactly like me. And that when you're not, something's wrong with you, right? My way of being a person in the world and thinking and feeling and acting is the right way. And if you are not matched up with it, you're the wrong way, right? It's just that. And by the way, you know, if you have relationships with people, you can see how they get fucked up when you're in that mind frame, right? And how when you're accepting them as a different person, it's much better. It's, I think, almost the same dynamic writ large.
So here's the last question that speaks to the question of off-ramping from a Cold War. It seems like, from my perspective and part of your perspective, that both sides have to, with empathy, accept certain facts about the other. There's a good Atlantic article today about how one of the few areas of bipartisan agreement today is actually no American troops positioned in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. That is a conversation which would have been very different 20 years ago, I think. But that is a concession that has been accepted. I don't think there is any world where anyone behind closed doors, it's different to say you won't say this publicly, but no one in the U.S. foreign policy establishment wants to admit Ukraine to NATO now. That's clearly over. What then? So these seem to be concessions that we have essentially made. What are concessions or acceptances or points of empathy that Putin and Russia need to accept about the status quo that could provide off-ramp? So if both sides have to meet somewhere, those are my examples of American concessions. I'm sure you could name some other ones too. What are American ones and what are Russian ones from your perspective to finish us out?
I agree with you that those are American ones. And I think another connected and important American one would be publicly acknowledging it, because I don't think it's enough to just think it or feel it or have it behind closed doors. I think America has to be able to say to Russia, we do not have the goal of moving NATO further in your direction. And I think the concession Russia has to make is accepting that that's enough, that they don't need to get a legal document in writing saying NATO will not expand, because I don't think the West is going to do that. And so I think if they can settle for some version, if they can say, look, we also recognize that A, we have a sphere of influence, but B, sphere of influences aren't the greatest, most wonderful thing in politics. They're problematic and they deny other countries sovereignty, and we don't like that either. So we're not going to promise not to invade Ukraine, but we don't want to, and we're not going to do it right now. And if you guys are able to say, you know, we're not really planning on and don't particularly want to expand to Ukraine, then we're actually close enough to prevent a war and see what we can do next to improve the relationship. I'm concerned that the two sides are, I mean, we'll see, it could change literally any minute with war or agreement. But over the last few weeks, they've been sort of stuck on the idea from Russia that it has to be crystal clear promise, and the position from the United States that we could never do that. Well, okay, I think both sides could compromise on the extremity of that and end up in close to the same place.
Here's what I'll say. I'll turn all my empathy around to Russia. You got to do the same thing. Nobody in this country has the appetite for a goddamn war in eastern Ukraine. Okay? So just
look, it's not going to happen.
Off the record, Anthony Blinken will be like, yeah, Putin, we're not fucking letting Ukraine into NATO. And same with Georgia. It's obviously yours. You know, please just whatever. And that's it. Like, enough with this bullshit paranoia constantly. It's like, we're not going to do it. You know, if we could just talk for real like this way, a lot could be solved.
I agree.
All right. Yep. Joe, I don't have anything else for you, man. I mean, I love talking to you. I love your show so much. If you guys haven't watched it, is it still on Amazon Prime? That's where I watch most of it. So there you go. I binged the whole thing on Amazon Prime. So anyway, really appreciate talking to you. I appreciate your art. I'm looking forward to your new show, and we should talk again soon because I enjoyed this.
Thank you, guys. This is a real pleasure. I actually love this conversation. So thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.